So the movie Ushpizin became very famous, both in Israel. It's an Israeli movie, but played all over the United States. One of my colleagues was telling me that they were planning on showing it to their students, but the problem was that you can't play movies over Zoom. This was a question that came up with show programming. You can't put movies on Zoom. They have like a way of disabling it. But anyway, it's a very popular movie, and part of the storyline, as is found in many many stories and tales, is that this individual has very little money. He saves up and he buys an extra beautiful etrog, and it causes a little bit of tension. And then these visitors, these so-called Ushpizin, they come in and they take the etrog, and they eat it, and causes a lot of sadness. So there's this idea of having an extra beautiful etrog, and I want to explore a little bit of what that's about, and see perhaps what we can learn from it. So the Torah tells us, on the first day of Sukkot, you shall take the product of hadar trees and branches of palm trees, boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook. You shall rejoice before Hashem for 7 days. Okay, so I like how this translation from Sepharia. It might come from the JPSNach, so I like how they translated hadar trees as Eitz Hadar as hadar trees, because how to translate hadar here is a little bit of a dispute. So Ibn Ezra on this pasuk says that the exegetes copied, they transmitted, ki pri Eitz Hadar hu etrog, that the hadar tree is specifically talking about the etrog, the citron, what we know to be the etrog. Ve'emet ki ein pri etz yoter hadar mimenu, because there's no tree more beautiful than it. Ve'darshu bo hadar bi'ilano b'derech hasmachta. They called it the fruit that resides on the tree. The word dar means to reside. Teshvu ki ein tedur, we're supposed to reside in the sukkah. We're supposed to sit in the sukkah like we reside in our own home. So this word dar, hadar, so the fruit that resides on the tree. So that's a little bit of a pun, it seems like Ibn Ezra is saying. But the idea that Ibn Ezra gets at is that that really the idea of calling the etrog a pre-Eitz Hadar is because there's no tree with fruit that's more beautiful. Okay, so etrog is the epitome of hidur, of beauty. And then Tziv corroborates. He says, "Lefi apshat muchach mitocho shehu etrog." We're talking about the fruit that's specifically called an etrog. She'ein pri asher alav chazazis ushar dvarim ha'me'achrim oto. There aren't things that make it ugly. Well, etrog shenachar harbem mechazazit, like an etrog whose beauty was diminished from chazazit. Chazazit is a kind of blemish on an etrog. Uperi shakato she'ein naki v'hadar. So the etrog has to be that it has to be extra beautiful, and even the little blemishes can make it look not as beautiful as it should be. So one has to be careful to buy an etrog that is clean, that's beautiful. So he's going along those lines, translating hadar as really referring to the beauty of the etrog and the importance of that. However, Ramban, in translating the word hadar, he says, the tree, it's called in Aramaic, it's called etrog. It's called that's the Aramaic word for this kind of tree. So nikra shmo b'lashon hakodesh hadar. So hadar in Aramaic is etrog. Ki perish etrog chamda. So you get this idea that etrog is chamda, but really the idea is that the that hadar is referring to the name of the tree. So it could be on the one hand that already in the pasuk we're getting this idea that an etrog has to be hadar, it has to be beautiful. On the other hand, maybe the pasuk isn't really telling us that much. It's just telling us that it happens to be that the name of the tree is hadar. Okay, so let's take a look at some of the halachic implications of the way a etrog, and in fact, really the entire arbeit minim, are supposed to look. So the Mishnah tells us at the very beginning of the third chapter of Masechet Sukkah, lulav hagazel v'hayavish pasul. The stolen lulav and the dry lulav are unfit. They are invalid. So this Mishnah and some of the Gemara that goes along with it is a very classic foundational Gemara that that many young students learn. I mean, it's very interesting to talk about the implications and what's going on with a lulav that's stolen when you steal something for the sake of a mitzvah. But we're going to focus on the other thing that's mentioned here, which is that if it's dry or completely dry, it is unfit. And why is that? Because Rashi says, "Debeinan mitzvah mehuderet." You need a beautiful mitzvah. So already I might be thinking that, okay, if I need to have a set of arba minim that are beautiful, so I'm probably thinking already of pre-Eitz Hadar. I'm thinking of a beautiful arba minim. But that's not the source that Rashi brings. Rashi says, the way I know that I'm supposed to have a beautiful lulav is because of the word ve'an vehu, right? Meaning in the Shir HaTayam, the 15th chapter of Sefer Shemot, the Song of the Sea, that Moshe sings after, and Bnei Israel sing after they cross the sea. So it says, Zekeli van Behu, this is my God, and I will glorify him. And the Gemara in Shabbos quotes a Tanaitic teaching, a Braita that says, Zekeli van Behu, hitna elifanav mitzvah. We're supposed to beautify ourselves with mitzvahs. So ase lefanav sukkah na'e, we should have a beautiful sukkah, velulav na'e, and a beautiful lulav, v'shovar na'e. The shofar should be beautiful. Tzitzis na'eh, our tzitzis, one's talis, should be beautiful. Sefer Torah na'eh, one should have a beautiful Sefer Torah. Chtobo lishmo b'dio na'eh, and you should use beautiful ink. V'kulmos na'eh, with a beautiful quail. V'lbar uman v'korko b'shirayin na'in. It should be written by an expert scribe, and you wrap the Sefer Torah in beautiful silk fabric. So this Baraita tells us that we're supposed to have two things related to sukkah that are supposed to be beautiful. Number one, sukkah, and number two, the lulav. And it seems from this that really seems to apply particularly with many mitzvahs. That, and I'm sure that this list isn't exhaustive, but it just gives many examples where, you know, you could build a sukkah that meets all the requirements, but it looks really shabby and use the worst possible materials that you can find. Or you can use a sukkah that's beautiful. Right, we can tell the difference between a talus that's new and beautiful, and a talus that's old and worn out. So so these are just some examples of mitzvahs where they're supposed to be beautiful. Okay, so if I just had this alone, I wouldn't make too much of it because that's just a general guideline in mitzvahs that they're supposed to be done beautifully. But the Gemara goes on to discuss the idea of a lulav that's dry. And here, we're talking particularly about the palm branches. So it says, Tana Yavish Pasul, a dry lulav is unfit. Rabbi Huda Machshir, but Rabbi Huda allows it. So Rava comes and says, I'm a Rava, Machloket Belulav. It's actually a dispute with regard to a lulav. The Rabbanan Savre, Makshina Lulav Le'etrog. The rabbis who say that a dry lulav is unfit see the lulav and the etrog as being juxtaposed. They're connected. Right? First, the Torah told us that we're supposed to take pre-Eitz Hadar, and then we're supposed to take the lulav. So the two are connected. So ma etrog ba'e hadar afula ba'e hadar. Just like an etrog is required to be beautiful, so too a lulav is required to be beautiful. So here, from this Gemara, it actually seems like that there's something in particular about an etrog that because it's called a pre-Eitz Hadar, that it's supposed to be beautiful. And therefore, we learn from that that lulav is also supposed to be beautiful. So that's already telling me that something stands out about the arba minim, that while other mitzvahs are supposed to be beautiful also, maybe there's something particular about the arba minim. And on the other hand, Rabbi Huda savar lo makshin lulav etrog. So lulav and etrog are two separate categories, two separate laws. Of Abba etrog, do you recall hadar ba'inan? But with etrog, everybody agrees that we require beauty with an etrog. So from here, it seems like that it's very, very important that at least everybody agrees that the etrog has to be beautiful because it's called a pre-Eitz Hadar. So we read that part very literally in the pasuk that not only is an etrog sort of by definition called Hadar, but we're supposed to have an etrog that's Hadar. But perhaps we extend that to the arba minim as well, and that makes it unique. But in Shulchan Aruch, so we'll see in a little while that it discusses, how much you have to spend on an etrog and to what extent you have to go to that. So in order to get there, we have to understand a Gemara in Bava Kamma. So Rabbi Zera said in the name of Rav Huna, the mitzvah, if you're purchasing an object to which through which we fulfill a mitzvah, ad shlish, you spend up to a third. Okay, so from that it sounds like that if I have $60 in my bank account, I should spend $20 on a mitzvah. Okay, so here's going to be the problem. My shlish, what do you mean one third? Ilema shlish beito, if I was going to say that I should spend a third of my entire estate. Okay, so maybe let's say even if I have $600,000 in my bank account, which would be pretty nice. But if you have $600,000 in your bank account and you spend $200,000 on a mitzvah, okay, let's say that you could do that. So elameata yidrame leitzlata mitzvata leite lekule beita. So if I have to spend up to a third on a mitzvah, so that means that I'm going to run out of money because first I'm going to spend $200,000 on the mitzvah and then another $200,000 on a mitzvah, another $200,000. I'm going to keep having to spend up to a third. I'm going to deplete all my resources that way. Sure, this probably would, decrease incrementally. So once you spend the first $200,000, so then you're down to $400,000. So it'd be a third of that. But even so, you could still very easily, in just one day, you do three mitzvahs and you have to spend that much money. So you're depleting everything. So what do we mean that I have to spend up to a third on a mitzvah? So Rabbi Zera tells us, behider mitzvah adu shlish b'mitzvah. No, we're talking about when you embellish a mitzvah, you should spend up to a third more than the baseline cost of that mitzvah. So by Ravashi shlish milagav or shlish milabar. So the question is, let's just say I have an etrog and our baseline etrog this year cost $30. So the question is, do I have to spend an extra $10, right? So I'm adding a third of what the original cost is, or does it mean that that if I divide that 30 into two, I spend three times more than that? So that's the question. But the Gemara says teku. We don't really know, but we know. But that basically you're marking up the mitzvah a third. So somehow or another, you're spending, if a baseline etrog were to cost 30, so maybe you should spend 40 or 45. That's what the Gemara seems to be saying. And in Eretz Yisrael, B'marava, they said in the name of Rabbi Zera, Ad shlish mishalo mikan ve'elach mishal kadosh baruch hu. So once you've spent a third to embellish the mitzvah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take care of the rest. So, okay, it's a nice idea that if we put in our little bit, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help us fulfill the mitzvah, will help us in what is necessary, etc. Okay, but we have this idea that a person should spend a third on a mitzvah. And Rashi explains, he again singles out lulav or tzitzis or sefer Torah, should add a third of what you have. Rashi explains that, let's just say if I have two sefer Torah, if I find two sefer Torah, and one is nicer than other, so I only have to buy the nicer one if it's only less than a third or around a third more than the other one. And again, quotes the idea of Zeki Levi and Behu that we're supposed to do beautiful mitzvahs. So if I have two items, and let's say one is slightly nicer but costs a little more, so I should get that. If it costs more, if it would be more than a third, more than that, then I don't have to do it. So that's what so Rashi says, that you know, should try to if you have two, so you should pick the nicer one. But Rabbeinu Tam, his grandson, is quoted by the Smaga saying that it doesn't mean that you should always, you know, spend up to a third more than what you would have on a particular Sefer Torah or an Esrog, because that could also, that could go on and on to absolute no end. If I keep spending more, if I keep marking it up a third, so I'm gonna, it's, you know, so when do you say that you've done enough? So rather, he says that if you bought a baseline Esrog, let's just say it was the size of an egos, which is a nut or an egg, and you find a nicer one that's only a third more, so you should spend it. But once you already have an esrog that's, let's say, the size of an egg, so you don't have to add more on that. So we put limits. It sounds like that the way we're understanding the Gemara, we're putting limits on to what extent I have to spend more. Okay, that's sort of the important point to get from here. That we're supposed to spend a little more to do hiddur mitzvah, but there's a point where we say ad kan, you've done enough. And in fact, the Smag mentions that Rabban Gamliel bought an etrog for 1,000 zuz. I don't know exactly how much 1,000 zuz is, but let's say it's a lot of money. Once you're quoting 1,000 of something, so it's a lot of money. So he says chumrahu milipo b'mnei mitzvot hayuchav vivod alav. So Rabban Gamliel was a particularly learned person, pious person. And he was very connected to the mitzvah. If I'm not mistaken, he also came from a decent amount of money. I think he was part of the family of Rabbi Huda Hanasi. Rabbi Huda Hanasi was known to be wealthy. So he was wealthy enough, and he had enough affinity for the mitzvah, perhaps beyond the average person, that he could do that. But nobody's really expected to spend that much on their esrog. And we'll come to a story about that towards him. So Shulchan Aruch tells us that if I buy an esrog that is appropriate to fulfill the mitzvah, so let's just say it's the size even of a small egg, right, which is not a particularly big, it's not necessarily, you know, something that's glitzy and stands out. And then I find something that's a little bigger, so I should try to spend, if there's only a third of a difference, I should try to spend that in order to get the nicer ones. And then he says there's another opinion, as we saw with Rashi. So the other opinion is that you sort of compare to the esrogim, and you try to buy the nicer one if you, but only up to a third more than you would have otherwise. Okay, and then the Rama adds, Umisha ain lo esrog, somebody who doesn't have an esrog, ushar mitzvah overis, or another mitzvah that's going to pass. Okay, right. We're talking, not necessarily talking about, you know, talis tefillin, and that's going to last a long time. So maybe it's worth the expenditure. But an esrog, you're going to have to buy a new one every single year. Okay, and you know what your income is. So if you don't have an esrog, or you don't have enough money for an esrog, so answer your klavasa is ala honrab. You don't have to spend your whole estate on it, right? Just as Chazal said, "Hamin vasbeis al yavasbeis yosir mechomish." We're not supposed to spend more than a fifth of our assets, which that line we often use to refer to tzedakah. That by tzedakah, we're not supposed to spend more than 20%. You know, unless perhaps one's a billionaire, maybe they can afford that. But we also say that with mitzvahs, that you definitely don't spend more than a fifth. So maybe you're supposed to spend, you know, at least a third. Maybe you could spend up to a fifth, but definitely not more than that. Okay. Now, if I'm trying to avoid doing, violating a mitzvah, so let's just say I'm in a situation where maybe I'll be mechal Shabbos, I'm stuck somewhere, but if I spend a lot of money, I'll be able to get out of it. Okay. So then you have to spend as much as you could spend. But in order to do a mitzvah, especially a passing mitzvah, So there's a line to where we say you should spend. Okay, so the Mishnah Berurah here says, the Torah tells us, it gives us the pasuk that we're supposed to take the arba minim, and he explains that Chazal understood that the Prietz Hadar is talking about the etrog. Right? Why is it hadar? Because the inside and the outside, the fruit and the outer peel have a similar taste. Uchtif hadar she'enah v'hadar v'tero v'gidulo. So it should look beautiful. And then he says, "Ufisha kol el harba meaning ktuvim pasuk echad lemeining zemiza." So because all the four species are in the same pasuk, so we learn out the different requirements from each other. V'korcha kol harba meaning tzrichim liyonayim mehudarim. So we've been focusing a bit on Astrog, maybe a little bit on the love, but Mishnah Berurah explains that because they're really all part of the same pasuk, really all of the four species should be beautiful, and that's how we paskin that anything that affects the hitter of the four species, we are supposed to try to do. So one of those examples again is the dryness. So the most common example of where something might dry out is a revo. So we'll come to that in a little bit. So some examples when it comes to an esrog, for example. So it says that mechot mova elach from the sort of from the where it starts to get thinner. Tehanu m'makom shemachil shefa ata pitma posel chazazis v'kol shinui mar b'choshu. Any sort of blemish or change in appearance can invalidate it based on the idea of hitter. And there's some who say that even any amount of dryness can also invalidate it. So Mishnah Berurah says, Davka kshenira lakol. That's specifically when you're able to see it. So what does that tell me? That the idea of hitter is a little bit, it's that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, or at least, the many beholders that are able to see it. So this isn't about a technical requirement of the esrog and what sort of there, but it's a question of what you can see, right? If it looks beautiful, so you don't need the magnifying glass to try to find the blemish, but does it look beautiful? And if it looks beautiful in your eyes, and it would look beautiful to everybody else, and you wouldn't see these stains, so then that's fine. And by the way, it's something we can probably learn about people in general also, is that obviously. There's some flaws that are really glaring that are problematic, but when we look at other people, so we don't have to go looking for the flaws. If there's a flaw that's really out there, then that's something needs to be addressed, but we don't need to go looking for those flaws in other people where they don't stand out, and we don't need to point that out. So that's the same thing with an esrog, that it's not like when it comes to an animal when you're offering a korban. So any blemish doesn't matter, doesn't really matter what you perceive. You have to look very carefully and make sure there's really nothing there, because the actual the actual animal can't have a blemish. But here the concern is not about an inherent blemish per se, but it's about the appearance of it. It's about how beautiful it is. Okay. So Shulchan Aruch goes on to tell us, another example that ends up being very relevant, that an arava that is dry, or if the leaves fall off, or if they're cut off, they are invalidated. So Mishnah Berurah says, "V'dad yavish v'niktam rosha humitam hadar." The issue of them drying or them being cut off is an issue of hitter. Okay, so a dry arava doesn't look nice. It looks like it's withered. It doesn't beautify the mitzvah. You can tell when it looks like it's really nabach, and it's not fit for the mitzvah anymore at that point. And even so then there's also discussion: what happens when the leaves fall off? So some say that's a problematic because it's missing things. But the Rishon Rabbeinu Manoach says that that even the leaves falling off is considered to be an issue of hitter, right? That when the leaves fall off in the winter, we start to see that as sort of it's getting kind of yucky outside. So we don't want our mitzvah, we don't want the aravos to look like that. So that is what the Mishnah Berurah comes to tell us, that hitter is relevant to the arava, something to look out for. That's one of the more common problems. I've started over the years, especially being in New York with access to being able to buy extra arava. So my aravas actually last pretty well this year. Even today, when I thought about changing them, so I realized that I probably could use a little bit of a change, but for some reason, I didn't even, knowing that I had access to more arevos, I didn't go crazy about refrigerating them and putting them in water. Somehow lasted pretty well this year. It was kind of miraculous. But nonetheless, I changed it this morning. Fine. Esrog is the arba meaning are supposed to be beautiful. It could be because it's about making mitzvahs in general beautiful, but we also have the idea that specifically the esrog being pre-Eitz Hadar, that applies to all of the arba meaning, and we're extra careful. We don't have, we might say that tzitzis and tefillin should be beautiful and sukkah should be beautiful, but we don't spend nearly as much time discussing the beauty of those mitzvahs the way we do with lulav and esrog. There's obviously something very unique about that. Chasam Sofer discusses what happens if somebody has an esrog, okay, and it has lots of spots and things on it, some bruises. So he's asked the question, what happens there? So he says, umiyode im humimar ha esrog. Maybe is it from originally from the, is that just how the esrog originally appeared? And he says, nearly the hava hadar kevan shabal ayade mitzvaso zahu hodo behadaro. That if a person uses the esrog so much and they're so involved in it that it starts to overuse, it just starts to, it's not as, anytime you start to use something, a book that hasn't come off the shelf is going to look a lot cleaner than the book that has been used, has been annotated in. And same thing, Lahav deal with a phone that comes in the screen has no smudges or scratches or whatever. So same thing with the esrog. When you first buy it, it might look a certain way. If it gets used a lot, then maybe it gets worse. Oh, so here's where I think the problem was actually. I think the problem was that a lot of people were using it. Now, that's where it wasn't just one person using it a lot, but it's the fact that it was an esrog that was being passed around to different people. So the question was, if it starts to get bruised up a little bit, so what's the halacha? So he says there's nothing more beautiful than that from the fact that the mitzvah, that was used so much for mitzvah. And I think that's very powerful because, again, the idea of hitter here is about how it appears to us. So it's not about the technical inherent qualities of the esrog, but it's about how our perception of it is. So if the esrog, starts to lose a little bit of its touch, specifically because people are using it for a mitzvah, there's nothing more beautiful than that. There's nothing more beautiful than all people being engaged with the mitzvah and making the esrog come as a result of that. So I thought that was, I think that's a very extremely powerful idea from the Chasam Sofer. Okay, so we've discussed so far the importance of having hiddur, hidur, of having beauty with the lulav and esrog, and perhaps we can extend that to all mitzvos. And that can lead, and in fact does lead to a desire among many people to spend and spend, particularly on Asrog and even on many mitzvot. And it almost seems like that's like, you know, everybody should be going after that. But what happens if somebody is not able to require to acquire an Esrog that's extra beautiful, or mean they're extra beautiful? So the Shulchan Aruch says, "B'shasa dechak she'en yimsa kasher kol apsulim notlin ve'en mevarchin." Most of the things that invalidate a lulav of an Esrog, if you don't have access to any other regular lechatchila kosher lulav, you're allowed to use them. Don't make a bracha on them, but you're still allowed to do them to do the mitzvah. Wow. Okay, because there's a lot of discussion about what invalidates a lulav and esrog, and we try to be extra makpid, try to be extra particular to have an arba minim that meets these standards of being having hidur, and there shouldn't be anything lacking in hidur. And yet, the Shulchan Aruch tells us that b'shasa dechak, these are still valid. And the Ramah adds that there's some who even allow a dry lulav. So we said that dry lulav is puzzle. That's what the Mishnah said. But that's only because of hidur. But if you don't have another lulav, then you can still use it. And the Ramah says even if there are other dry lulavs around, you don't necessarily have to go out of your way to find that. Specifically with the lulav, with the other four minim, if they're dry, maybe you shouldn't use them. And then he says that some people even make it with hadas, and maybe you can rely on that on shasa dechak. So this idea of shasa dechak, even when we're talking about hidur, or perhaps especially because we're coming a hidur, so the other side of that is this idea of shasa dechak comes up. Shasa dechak means that you know I'm supposed to do a mitzvah in a particular way. There's a lechachila. There's a way I ideally should do a mitzvah, but sometimes you can't always do it in the most ideal way. And what do you do in that situation? So there's a principle, shasa dechak kadiyavad dami, that when I'm in a pressing situation, extenuating circumstances, there's no other alternative. So what might not have been ideal, what might have been sort of the less ideal choice, becomes the most ideal in that situation, and you're allowed to do it. So even though we have put so much emphasis on having a beautiful arba minim, and not only, and there's really two aspects to this. Number one is that just in general they should look beautiful, and then on the other hand there's that sort of like, do I spend the extra to get an even more beautiful than the average, which is itself already considered hidur, right? The $30 arba minim set, no one gets from the shul, meets the requirements of hidur, and yet some people will go out of their way to buy the extra mehudar ones. Okay, so there's sort of those two aspects of it. And if I can't even meet that minimal standard, there's still what I can do in shasa dechak when there's extenuating circumstances. You can still use a little of an esrog in many of these circumstances, even if it doesn't look like something that's particularly beautiful the way we would want to. And why is that? So Mishnah Berurah says the reason why you might take an arba minim that's not beautiful. So kedei shelo tishtakach toras lulav miyisrael, because especially in environments where maybe it would have been hard to get an arba minim, if we set the standard so high, then people might not have the opportunity to do the mitzvah, and year after year it's gonna get forgotten. In fact, this year in theory we didn't even need to do lulav and esrog at all, because technically speaking, from the Torah, only in the Beit HaMikdash they did lulav and etrog every day. But outside the Beit HaMikdash, really it was only required on the first day. But after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, Rabban Yonchan ben Zakkai enacted that we do arba minim all 7 days. Okay, so there's a real concern about this mitzvah getting forgotten. And if we set the standard so high that, yes, you know, the Torah says it should be hidur, it should be beautiful, so should push and push that standard, but if we don't forget what the baseline requirement is, if we don't forget even what we're allowed to do in extenuating circumstances, then there's another risk, perhaps, of losing the whole mitzvah. Now, the Aruch HaShulchan says that nowadays, when there's not so many dry lulavs, so we shouldn't rely on this. But it's still an important point to know that on the one hand, we have this emphasis on Sidur. On the other hand, there is such a thing as Shas HaDchak. There are some times where there are extenuating circumstances. So I can mention two kinds of, perhaps, extenuating circumstances for the time being. So first, I want to share a story because it's a story that I guess it describes one particular situation, but it is sort of an interesting commentary on a phenomenon that has existed for centuries about the way people treat buying an extra mehudar esrog. So the story reads like this: Rishlam Eisen was a dayan and Mor Tzedek in Yerushalayim more than 50 years ago. He was also known as an expert in the kashrus and hidurim of esrogim and lulavim. As each sukkah's approach, hundreds of people would appear at his house to show him his aramini, which they purchased, and to make sure that it was, met all of the extra mehudar requirements, right? So one year, an avrich, somebody who was studying in kolel, approached him with a beautiful esrog, mehudar in all its aspects, to receive Rav Eisen's approval. And editorially, so you can guess this guy is expecting to get a big yasher koach and a huge approval. So Rav Eisen examined it and shook his head, saying, "This esrog is not for you. It's not for you." So the avrich was astounded. He had delved into lochos of arba minim. He learns a kolo. He spent a lifetime learning what to look for in the arba minim. And he had spent a considerable amount of time purchasing such a mehudar esrog. He looked very, very hard to find this esrog. So why was Rav Eisen telling him that this esrog was not for him? So he asked Rav Eisen, is there a halachic problem with this esrog? Right? He thinks that he learned everything. I did everything right. So instead of answering him, Rav Shalom asked him a question. What do you do? So the Avrich answered, I learn in Kol on Yerushalayim. How much did you get paid? So you know where this is going. Obviously, Kol guy doesn't get paid a lot of money. So the Avrich answered him and told him the exact amount of money he received from his Kol. And how much are they asking for this esrog? Inquired Rav Shalom. So the Avrich answered that they were asking a considerable amount of money. So Rav Eisen said, this is what I thought from the beginning. You are right. The esrog itself is mehudar. It's extremely beautiful. But if you listen to me, I would advise you to purchase a cheaper esrog, and with the remaining money, purchase something for your wife, likvod yom tov. This is the true kavod yom tov. Okay, so Rav Shechter likes to say that with every chumrah comes a kula. With every stringency comes a leniency. So if you're extra stringent to buy an extra beautiful esrog, so in this case, maybe the guy was being lenient about buying something like Yom Tov for his wife, which is, by the way, is a halacha. It's straight in the Rambam that one's supposed to buy the husband's supposed to buy jewelry for his wife in advance of Yom Tov. So he's being lenient on that. And Rav Shechter says perhaps one's being lenient on tzedakah. Maybe if you're going to buy a $200 esrog, so maybe buy the $50 esrog and spend the other $150 you would have spent on the esrog on tzedakah. So that's a tension that we often face in the idea of being machmir or going for the extra mehudar and being mekel. On the one hand, there's something to be said for going our best and going out of our way and serving Hashem, do mitzvah beautifully, to go an extra mile. But there's also a point where we're not required to spend more than a certain amount. Case of we talked about spending more than a third of the markup. There's a point where we say, you know what, you've done your job, and going that extra far is a little bit unhealthy. And I thought that this was a good thing to talk about, particularly this year, because we've had to face a lot of Shas HaDchak situations that we don't normally have to face. One of the very first questions that came up with COVID was, it was Purim last year, and there were some people who are already quarantined. Many of us who didn't even, we knew of somebody, we heard in the news that somebody had COVID, but a lot of us weren't chill. But some people were quarantined. So can you listen to Megill via live stream? And based on Rav Moshe Feinstein, the idea was that ideally, we don't listen to Megillah through a microphone or through any sort of sound transmitting device. But Shas HaDchak, Kedivyat Kedivyat Rami, you have no other choice. So the ideal option becomes to listen to Megillah via live stream. Same thing with Tefillah B'Tzibur. It's ideal to daven in Tzibur, and yet we had no other choice. So the right thing to do became to daven at home. And the question came up with Kitnios and Gebrox. People didn't have access to food. So that's you did what you have to do. There was a question of selling pots and pans. If you bought new pots and pans, particularly around Pesach, and you can't go to the Kelim Mikvah. So the idea of selling them to a non-Jew while you're using them is not ideal, but okay, music during Sfira and during 3 weeks, the custom is not to do it, but we sort of, you know, there are many people who did it with the minhag because this year was a little different. And same when it came to the piyutim on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, Herschel Schachter wrote a tshuva just to explain the fact that that yes, the piyutim are, you know, a treasured minhag, and we're not supposed to change our minhagim. And yet, when it came to the idea of saving a life, he said we have to follow the instructions of Rabbi Akiva Eger, who got rid of piyutim when there was a pandemic or some sort of epidemic in his lifetime, and the way Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was machmir and pikuach nefesh. We have no other choice. Sometimes you give up on holy minhagim in order to save lives. So having that priority becomes extremely important. On the one hand, we go after the hitter when we can, and especially when it makes sense. But on the other hand, there's also the idea of shas hadachak. And that became true in some ways when it came to buying lulav and esrog in general, that maybe people in a normal year would go out and they would pick their own lulav and esrog and they would examine them all. This year, the safest thing to do was just to say, you know, I will get a, you know, I will get, I will try to shoot for a particular price range, and what I get is what I get. And that's what I do. Question comes up, do you have to do Hataras Nedarim if you have a particular minhag that you have, or you have a good practice that you do? So do you have to annul that vow, not just on Erev Rosh Hashanah, but a particular, go, you know, directly in front of a Beis Din and get rid of that? So if you have a minhag tov, if you have something that's mehudar in the way that you serve Hashem, and for whatever reason choose to get rid of it, so normally you would do Hataras Nedarim. But Rav Schachter said when there's a Shas Hadchak, so when we accept that some sort of minhag like that, we didn't mean it four times when they're extenuating circumstance. And that's, I think, you know, the way we've learned to adapt and be resilient is to understand that there's a time to go after the hidur, and there's a time to go out of our way to go the extra mile and to strive extra hard. And then there's a time to understand, you know, what we have to do in order to do what we have to do. And that's also sometimes the best thing, the most acceptable thing to do. And that's that, you know, almost as I'm saying that, I'm thinking of Kohelet, L'chol Zman Va'et Tachat HaShemayim. There's a time for everything under the sun. There's a time to do hitter and sometimes to do Shas HaDachak. And just the last thing I want to close with before we start Yisker is there's another idea about why a dry lulav or a dry arba minim would be invalid. This comes from Yerushalmi. So it says, Hayavish Pasol, Hashem lo hameti mihalu luka, that the dead will not serve Hashem. Okay, so the idea of something's dry, so it's, you know, talk about plants, so when they dry up, so they're dead. And the dead don't praise Hashem. And I think there's something to be said for applying that, especially in this situation, that, you know, as we are facing new restrictions in Queens and cases are going up, And the big questions are what's essential and what should be allowed for religious purposes. And the thing we have to remember is lo hameti mihaluluka, that if we want to daven b'tzibur and we want to do mitzvahs and we want to do them in public fashion, so we're not going to be able to do that if we're not machmir on pikuach nefesh. It's only if we stay alive that we can do that. So this idea of shas hadachak right now applies because the real hitter mitzvah right now is to is really to protect our lives. The biggest hitter mitzvah that we can be doing is to protect our lives and lives of others so that we can continue to praise Hashem. And I think also going into Yisker, I think that's something, you know, an important value for us to remember, to think about what's essential, what's appropriate in our lives. And we should try to, in certain areas of lives, we should strive for Hidur, to make our lives meaningful, to do things that bring honor to our ancestors in a Mehudar way. And on the other hand, there's also the question of remembering what's essential in life, what are things that are important to us, and making sure we don't lose focus and we keep our eye on the prize, to live lives of meaning, living lives of rich relationships with Hashem, with other people. That's the real Hidur in life that we can go for. Okay.